final case of the day is Smith against Anderson.
May it please the court.
Mr. Palmer.
May it please the court. As you probably know from the cover of our briefs, I was appointed counsel for Mr. Smith in the civil appeal in connection with my position with the Notre Dame Law School Moot Court. The principal author of the briefs in this case was Mr. Kyle Mowry. Normally, Mr. Mowry would be presenting this oral argument, but he is in Europe on vacation at this time, and I am in South Bend and making the argument for him. Let me begin with what this case is not. Although the turnaround process in the Illinois Department of Corrections has been subject to much litigation, this case is not about the turnaround procedures. That procedure only forms a background. We're not challenging the validity of the turnaround procedure. What we're challenging in this case is the summary judgment entered against Mr. Smith when his arrest, the warrant issued for his violation of a parole condition, was based on knowingly false information.
The question I have for you, Mr. Palmer, was whether any knowingly false information played a causal role. Suppose the officer had represented that Smith is known to be a space alien from Venus, and we will assume that that's false. He's probably from one of the asteroids instead, right? But made that blatantly false statement. But Smith did not have an approved site and therefore didn't have a lawful place to live. Could there be liability for making that false statement?
There could be liability, Your Honor, on several different bases. First basis is that the reason given that he did not have an approved site because of electronic monitoring, that would be something that would require investigation. Right.
But did he, in fact, have an approved site?
He did not.
He did not?
He did not.
So how can any statement, whether it's about his being a Venusian or his having been convicted of bank robbery when he hadn't been, or, right, you can make a very long list of false statements, but if none of the false statements played any causal role, why would they be a source of liability?
They are a source of liability because it did not stop at his initial arrest on March 24th. It continued with additional false information provided, which resulted in his continued incarceration. And if I could, Your Honor, just go through the time.
Was it the false statements that led to still being in prison or the lack of an approved site?
It was false statements.
Is there an argument that sometime during this extra 6 months he spent in prison, is there an argument that he got an approved site during that time, but because of a false statement, he still wasn't let out?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
What there is evidence of is in June of 2014, when the prison finally got around to investigating one of the host sites, his mother's house. The only reason for not approving that host site was, one, there were minor children in the home.
You mean she could correct the problem?
Well, not that she could correct the problem, Your Honor. It was not a problem according to his mandatory supervised release. The only conditions originally on that release were substance abuse counseling, check in with the parole counselor, and approved housing. I'm sorry. Also, registration as a sex offender. When he was held on the day he was supposed to be released, there were two statements made. One, that he was in violation because he could not find a host site that would accommodate electronic monitoring. There was no requirement of electronic monitoring in his parole. The second statement, which is demonstrably true, is we've checked all of his potential host sites. We've checked with the family. Nothing is consistent with what he's required. They didn't check with the family. There was no investigation of his host sites. They finally, in May, 3 months later, 2 months later, Mr. Smith's mother called the prison for the second time and said, hey, come investigate my house. We want him to be turned free. We want to be a host site. We can handle it. So 2.5 hours after she made that call, Mr. Anderson went in and requested that electronic monitoring be added to his condition. And it was. And he still didn't investigate that house until June. And in June, he went to the house and ruled that it was not a suitable host site because there were three minor children there and there was internet access and computer access. Those were not conditions of his parole, either the discretionary conditions or mandatory conditions. They were not mandatory because he was convicted of sexual criminal battery with a person over 18, unable to consent, back in 2001. He served his term. He served his mandatory supervised release. He was subsequently arrested for driving under a revoked driver's license. Went back to prison again. Went back to Cook County Jail. Served his term, thought he was getting out. What happened then is simply the whole system failed him. He wasn't even asked to provide host sites.
You need your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. He was not even asked to present host sites until after he was already back on the day he was released. It would have been impossible for Mr. Anderson to conduct the investigation that he said he conducted. And if he had, he would have found that the mother's home was suitable for a supervised release. Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Your Honor's counsel. May it please the court. I am Christopher Turner, the Illinois Assistant Attorney General, representing the defendant appellee, Paul Anderson, parole agent. This court should affirm summary judgment in Anderson's favor for at least three reasons. First, because the undisputed record shows that Anderson had reasonable suspicion, that is, reasonable suspicion existed when he issued the challenged violation report, and reasonable suspicion is an absolute defense to Smith's false arrest claim. Second, because he's entitled to qualified immunity, because there was no clearly established law demonstrating that Smith was entitled to release to MSR when the department had not approved a host site for him. And third, because there's no genuine issue of fact that any false statements.
Excuse me. MSR?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I should slow down.
Using real English words would help us non-specialists.
Sure. No, but it's mandatory supervised release, but I think we'll just call it parole. I'll try to call it parole.
It's fine with me if you call it FRED, as long as you avoid weird acronyms.
I'll try to avoid the acronyms, Your Honor. But there's no genuine issue of fact that any false statement in the violation report was the but-for cause of Smith's subsequent detention. Now I want to focus on the first issue about reasonable suspicion. That's what the case is really about. The court below had found probable cause, but reasonable suspicion is the lower standard. The existence of reasonable suspicion that a parolee has not satisfied a condition for release to parole is an absolute defense to that parolee's false arrest claim, regardless of whether or not there were any false statements that had supported the challenge detention or arrest. And that's what we have here in the undisputed record. There was no dispute that at the time that Anderson issued the gate violation report, the department had no approved housing form. And there was no dispute that the department cannot release a parolee to his parole unless it has satisfied itself that and approved a site for him as being suitable and proper. Now, counsel argues here, basically looking at subsequent events, that down the line he challenges whether or not the rejection of the host site was proper. But that's not the issue in the case. The issue in the case is whether or not reasonable suspicion existed when Anderson issued the report. That's what was challenged below, and that's what he argues was the violation of the Fourth Amendment here. And under these facts, it reaches the standard. Now, reasonable suspicion is an objective standard. It's a low bar. It doesn't require that Anderson thought more likely than not that he had violated his condition for release. It deals in probabilities. And all it requires is an objective manifestation that Smith had not satisfied his condition for release to parole. And that was here. It's under Administrative Code Section 1610.110. And that code section prohibits the department from releasing a parolee to his parole until it has satisfied itself that he has suitable arrangements for a proper and approved residence and where he'll serve it. Here, because there was no approval, the existence is clear. I mean, it's actually proven more likely than not, though it doesn't need to meet that standard. So under the case we cite, Knox v. Smith, where this court had found that a parole violation report in that case was supported by reasonable suspicion, even though there was an issue of fact whether or not there were knowing false statements in the violation report, still that was enough to affirm summary judgment. Now, on appeal here, in his argument, Smith and in his reply brief has not disputed that reasonable suspicion is an absolute defense. Therefore, it doesn't matter whether or not there were false statements in the report, and we don't take issue for purposes of this motion.
It's a good thing you're not, that you've got this reasonable suspicion. This is not the first time this Illinois practice, the turnaround practice, has been before this court. Are you aware of that?
I am, Your Honor. But as
and you know how bad that was.
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
It's a good thing you're on different grounds here.
Thank you, Your Honor. And this case is not about the validity of the statement. It's not about a parolee who is still currently being detained during his parole. This is a case for damages, a civil action for damages. And this is also a much different question, looking at whether or not reasonable suspicion existed at the time of a challenged action, that is the violation report. Now, Smith's argument is that on appeal seems to be that there's no reasonable suspicion because the proposed sites they had submitted were proper under the administrative code. Now, first, he never made that argument below, so he forfeited it. But also, the administrative code section doesn't mandate the release of inmates just because they've submitted a proper host site. It prohibits the department from releasing them until it's satisfied itself, that is, until it's investigated and confirmed and approved the house site for them. That did not happen here. And indeed, because of Mr. Smith's specific situation, he did not actually transfer to the Department of Corrections to prison until the end of his term. So he arrived under the department's jurisdiction on the date of his parole. So, and under, as the undisputed record showed, it was the head of the sex offender unit. When a sex offender arrives on the date of their parole, there's never sufficient time in order to investigate and confirm and approve the sites. And that's what happened here. There was no approved site. The supervisor directed Anderson to issue the report because there was no approved site, and so reasonable suspicion existed. Contrary to his argument as reply brief, approval is not a mere formality. We see that both in the record from the head of the sex offender unit, that there was insufficient time to complete an investigation of the sites, but also by the terms of the administrative code provision at issue, it doesn't state the department must release an inmate to parole just because they submitted a host site. It also doesn't require them to release someone to parole just unless that parole site somehow facially reflects that they would violate some independent condition of parole. The department is required to satisfy itself that the inmate has suitable arrangements for a proper residence. Smith claims in his reply brief that this provision would somehow give a blank check for the department to detain sex offenders, but he never asserted any sort of claim that the department's broad discretion violates to approve housing for serving or parole somehow violates the Fourth Amendment or any other constitutional provision. At most, in his brief, he argues that it's somehow inconsistent with the Prisoner Review Board's authority under Illinois law, under the Code of Corrections. Why we dispute that, the most important fact is, regardless of not, he's right that's a state law claim, that's a state law question for the state law courts, and wouldn't constitute a federal action or a basis for federal damages under Section 1983. That's what this court found in Brown v. Randall when it addressed a similar case by another Illinois sex offender who also, under the same provision, was detained during his parole because he didn't have approved housing. In this case, they affirmed summary judgment, and in affirming summary judgment, this court rejected a similar argument that the department's authority under that provision, 1610.110, was somehow inconsistent with the Prisoner Review Board's authority, and said, no, that is not a question, a federal question, that is not a federal claim. In addition, it would not be consistent with reasonable suspicion that somehow that a parole agent is supposed to predict in the future that a court might find that the provision in which they are applying in order to detain someone will later be found invalid under state law. Ultimately, it's Smith's cramped reading of this provision that would give sex offenders and other parolees basically carte blanche to obtain release to parole at a residence of their choosing, regardless of whether or not that site posed a risk, either to them successfully completing their parole or to the public safety. So I see my time's almost up, and I would ask just the court, remind the court that reasonable suspicion is an absolute defense to Smith's false arrest claim. So regardless of any false statements, here the undisputed record demonstrated that reasonable suspicion existed for Smith, that Smith had not satisfied his conditions for release to parole under Illinois law when Anderson issued the challenge report. Therefore, for these reasons and the reasons set forth in Anderson's brief, we request that the court affirm the district court's judgment in his favor. Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Anything further, Mr. Palmer?
Yes, sir.
What is a proper host site must be based on what the conditions of the parole are. This case, on June 9th, when Mr. Anderson ruled that the host site of Mr. Smith's mother was not proper, he based it on two conditions that were not part of the parole. There can be no reasonable suspicion that when the parole conditions are in writing, supposedly investigated by Mr. Anderson, and not applied to the host site, that he had reasonable suspicion to say that host site was not proper or not approved. That's like saying the investigator goes out there and says, I don't like the color blue your house is. It's not proper. Even though it's not in your parole conditions, I'm going to say you can't be approved and you have to stay in jail 6 months longer than what your parole or what your release date is. The undisputed evidence is that, well, when Mr. Anderson went to the house in June, he didn't say it was not proper for electronic monitoring, as he did earlier. He said there were two other conditions that were never referenced anywhere in the parole conditions. For those reasons, he could not have had reasonable suspicion. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Palmer, and we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. We hope you'll convey our thanks to Mr. Morey when he gets back from vacation.
I will.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.